Welcome to Level Up. In our last podcast, we talked about competency-based education with our school's principal, Chris Keim, and our district supervisor, Bonnie Flint. Today, we will talk with David Bong of Avant Assessment regarding the STAMP test, which we use in Davis School District with levels 4 and up, as well as with our immersion and Chinese programs. We are excited to talk to David about the STAMP test, its history, recent changes, the future, and more as we get into Level Up. Welcome to Level Up. I'm Roger Burt, joined today by our other hosts, Brandon Welker and Miles Nance. Davin Lemke is off preparing for the World Warcraft World Championships, so he'll be replaced today by Clearfield High School's own Kelsey Flint, who is our Davis School District Chinese lead teacher, and not related to Bonnie Flint, Davis School District World Language Curriculum Supervisor. We are also very happy to be joined by David Bong, CEO and co-founder of Avant Assessment. So STAMP is a test that we've been using in the Davis School District for at least a few years, as long as I've been here. I'm in my fifth year. And STAMP stands for Standards-Based Measurement of Proficiency and is the assessment tool that we use in our district as the common assessment for levels 4 and up, as well as some schools using the STAMP test for levels 3 and up. We also use the STAMP assessment in our immersion schools and for all students taking Chinese. So welcome everyone to our podcast today. We'll just get started. So I've been using the STAMP assessment with my levels 4 and up since my first year. Bonnie introduced that to me. I'm not sure if that was being done before I came here, but I was thrown right into it because I came to Clearfield mid-year and was scared to death to administer it.
Well, that was about the year when we started using it really in earnest. And Okay. There's a story to you coming here, you know, because you were hired mid-year to a teacher, replacing a teacher who had been sick, and her students who were in AP and IB in very high-stakes classes, they were getting a new teacher at mid-year. And they were struggling because of what had been going on before that with their teacher being sick and out so much. And so with the high-stakes program, we wanted to start doing some assessment with these kids as you were preparing them for the AP test. So I had had a hunch, because I work with some of the people at College Board, so I had a hunch that if we could get the kids to intermediate mid, they would get a 3 on the AP, or they were likely to, a 4 if they were intermediate high, and a 5 if they were advanced low. And so we tested your kids, I believe, in February of that year.
Right.
And you'd only been with them a couple of months at that point.
Yeah, two
maybe,
months tops.
To see like how prepared they were for the AP test, and then what we would need to do by May to get them there. So that was the first year that we started collecting data. And I know we're going to talk about that data more in depth. That's not the first year we started collecting data, but that was the first year we started doing the correlation between the STAMP and the AP. And we just saw the value with it for that. And so that's when we started really using it in earnest as our common assessment and as a guide for AP preparedness. So that was the year you started.
Well, yeah, and it was great. And we'll get more into that in just a bit. But first, David, thank you for being on, and we really appreciate it. If you could take a little bit and kind of describe the history of STAMP and I guess maybe Avant Assessment and how you have gotten to where you are.
Sure. Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me. I'm glad that the timing worked out with my visit to Utah. But STAMP was created at the University of Oregon by a team at the Center for Applied Second Language Studies. And they were experts in language assessment and language acquisition. Dr. Carl Falsgraf was the father of STAMP. And he came up with the idea because he had been heavily involved in immersion education and could see the importance of measuring language proficiency, not just grammar and what vocabulary words students had been able to memorize, which at the time was really the only assessment approach out there. So he created STAMP. used something back in the late 90s called the internet to deliver it, which was very novel at the time, and came up with assessments in a number of languages. The first language was Japanese, and that's kind of a common thread throughout our company. My wife and I both speak Japanese, lived in Japan for about 10 years, and Carl was a Japanese professor. And Kyle Ennis, who joined us as our first employee, he also was a Japanese teacher up in Portland. And Kyle's originally from Tooele, So we've got a Utah connection there as well. So STAMP was designed to measure proficiency. It measures all four skills, reading, writing, speaking, listening. It's, as I said, done on the internet, so it's designed to be engaging. It's adaptive, so that it adjusts to the level of the student. And that's something that was really, again, novel back around 2000 when we introduced the assessment. Most tests had been what they call fixed forms, which means everybody gets the same questions. So most of those questions are going to be either too hard or too easy. And that does a couple of things that are problematic. One, either kids are bored or overwhelmed. And you don't have those kinds of questions that really identify exactly where you are. If you're trying to find where someone's level is, you need to get questions that are very close to their exact spot where they are in proficiency. So it's just like the Utah Jazz, if they played some lousy team every week, you would never know how good they were. Right. But if they were playing a really good team and they could go seven games, then you'd find out what they could really do. So STAMP, as I said, started out with Japanese, then we added Spanish, and now is available in 14 languages this spring altogether. So we've got here a question for me. What languages do I have to go through kind of from east to west? So Italian, German, French, Spanish, English, Japanese, Korean, Cantonese for our elementary test. We have an elementary version. Chinese, Arabic, Hebrew, and now we're adding Polish and Korean this year as well. So I think that totals 14 altogether. It should. but those are the ones that we're adding. And we're seeing changes over time with the Seal of Biliteracy coming in and with the growth of immersion programs in a variety of languages, not just sort of the standard Spanish and French. We're seeing a need for assessments in a variety of languages. So we've added up to 14 this year. We're going to be adding a couple more next year that'll be regular four skills STAMP test. But we've also added a new line of assessments called WorldSpeak, which are writing and speaking assessments only. And those are in less commonly taught languages. So for many states, you can get a seal of biliteracy if you demonstrate proficiency at a certain level on those two skills. So we've launched them last year in two Somali languages. I always have trouble remembering them all. So Somali, Vietnamese, Filipino or Tagalog, and Yupik, which is an Alaskan language spoken in southwestern Alaska.
Wow.
And they're struggling up there because it's still a living language. But like everything else, if you don't have a goal, if you don't have an assessment, it's really hard to have a program that's effective. You need that rigor that's going to give you feedback on what students and programs are really accomplishing. So this year we've got a couple of more that we'll be rolling out. We have six more. Next year we've started looking at new languages and we've got some really interesting options. One that we're hoping to roll out is called Gullah, and it's a language spoken in South Carolina along the coast. The slaves, when they came over from West Africa, spoke a variety of languages. And in order to communicate among themselves and with their owners, they needed to develop a Creole, a new language, and it's developed into a real language. So Gullah is one of those languages that's really neglected and is kind of fading away. Mm-hmm. So we want to promote that as a language that students can get the seal for by having an assessment. So we're working with Charleston schools down there to develop that. Anyway, I excited about all these things that are going on in language.
But, so I guess maybe we could back up. What is your language background?
How did you get involved? So my background is Japanese. I was a Japanese history major in college and went over to Japan after college to study the language. So I studied in Tokyo for 2 years, came back for a while, and then went over and worked in a, I was a translator for a while and then worked in a Japanese company as a what they call a sarilimang, just hanging onto the strap with my 1.5 hour commute each way in those crowded trains. And then came back and returned again as an expat, so running an American firm in Japan. And that was one of the things that got me interested in the gaps that there exist in American education in terms of language. So my job when I went back was as a corporate investigator and security advisor. So we would investigate internal frauds and extortions and things like that in largely Western companies. And the common thread through all of them was that there was a misunderstanding between the employees and the manager, who was always from the West, from Europe or the US. And that built all kinds of frustration and animosity that sometimes resulted in those kinds of crimes occurring. We saw the same thing happening for Japanese companies overseas, where they misunderstood what was going on in culture, like the United States or Australia or wherever. And they became the victims of frauds as well. So it was kind of reassuring that everybody had the same problem. But it was distressing that people really didn't understand or appreciate the importance of understanding the other people, the people you're working with, their language and their culture, and just their general openness to different ways of doing things. So having that experience really made me interested in trying to do something to improve language.
That's fascinating. Thank you for developing something to fill in those gaps. And really, I find it interesting that you say it got online around the year 2000.
Correct.
Which is, from what I understand, our current ACTful proficiency guidelines have been tweaked, and it says on their website that they're the 2012 proficiency guidelines. But really, they've basically been in place since 96, is my understanding. So you really were like on top of the game.
Yeah, so Dr. Falsgraf was part of the group that helped put those together, and he could see the value if they were really implemented, and having a goal, having an assessment that would measure them was so critical. So that's why he was driven to do that.
Okay.
But yeah, they've basically been in place since then, and they haven't had any dramatic changes.
Yeah. Wow.
And since we've been talking about competency-based education, this fits in so well because we are one of the only content areas that knows our goal. We know what our proficiency expectations are, and we have a viable tool to measure it. So that puts us out in the forefront of what we're doing and gives us the opportunity to try new things. And it's always a little bit scary, but it's also really exciting and fun to be able to do what's right for kids and to have the tools to do it.
Right. I completely agree. I feel like I try a lot of new things in my classroom, always with that end goal in mind. And really, you learn from those types of things. You learn what works, what doesn't, what needs to be tweaked. And it's fun, and you just learn a lot.
Along that, where we're working in the district now with the IPAs and just developing those integrated performance assessments and trying to come up with, yes, these are the standards we want to reach, and these are the topics we've kind of covered, but going beyond that and just thinking about the skills that students are wanting to have for the assessment, but how that also impacts our classes as well, and what skills we focus on, and where it's not the 20, 30 years ago grammar, rote memorization, memorize this dialogue because you'll need to say where your grandmother's pen is when you're in France. Or, you know, it's interesting, we talk about as teachers the design with the end in mind, basically, where we're starting with these assessments and then kind of working that back and how and why are we doing this to make our classes better for the students.
I think with that, some would argue that we don't want to teach to the test, right? We don't want to focus all of our curriculum on teaching to the test. But when you have a proficiency-based assessment like the STAMP test, everything you do, I guess it could be what teaching to the test, but everything you're doing is helping them develop the skills, right? You have that backwards design. You have that proficiency level in mind that you need to get them to. And the STAMP test is really there to help us think, what are the most important skills I need to teach them so that they can reach that level of proficiency? So it's not in this case, it's a good thing, right? We want to teach to the test because we want them to be proficient.
Yeah. And I feel like on the STAMP test, teaching to the test is teaching everything because everything's fair game.
Absolutely.
And one of my favorite lines that I took away from my master's program was that there are two types of teaching to the test. There's teaching the exact vocabulary you know you're going to see on the test, the exact scenarios, the things that we know are completely very wrong. Mm-hmm. And there's teaching to the test in the sense that I know what skills you need, and I'm going to teach you the skills that will transfer to any situation in any scenario. And that's the beauty of the STAMP test as well as the IPA that we're working on, is really it's focusing on skills. And context can be whatever context you want. Mm-hmm. You can work within any context because you've got the skills necessary. So that's the biggest thing that I've really come to appreciate and understand with the STAMP test. I've always taken it with my students so I could see how they were being pushed and challenged, so that I could make my classroom a more direct reflection of that. Because and that came out of the direct reflection or correlation that we saw with the STAMP data and our AP success. And I want to get to that later. Maybe I'll just bring it up.
No, I'm just kidding.
I know what it was. I remember.
Because there's not many teachers that will actually dare take the STAMP test, honestly. And so when I always see Roger's name come up on the STAMP data, I always make note of it, because most teachers are a little bit afraid, like, what would that say as a reflection of me if my STAMP data isn't what I want it to be? But he always takes it.
I remember taking it my first year, which I think was the year, like a year and a half or so after you started. And it was a little nerve-wracking. It was really putting myself out there. And I thought, well, okay, if I'm going to require my students to do it, I guess I better. And our Chinese teacher last year did the same thing. And it was scary, but it also helped me think, oh, here are the skills. Okay, so this is what I did to navigate this part when I didn't know what to do. And I found it really helpful. And it was fun.
Yeah.
Good.
So that's good. In that weird twisted teacher way, it was really fun, right?
So maybe that's a challenge we can put out there for any teacher, really. If you want to see the skills and the things that your students need to be successful at any level, and especially driving towards AP, which is kind of the highest thing that we can offer, AP and IB here in high school, take the STAMP test and don't worry about it as a direct reflection of you or your ability. I took the one for heritage speakers because I have a heritage speakers class this year. And I told them, don't pay any attention to me because I'm going to be taking pictures and things so that I can look at home and study up and prepare a class that's more appropriate for my heritage speakers. But you guys don't get to open any other extra screens. I get to cheat. I get to fudge on this. But that was very different. And it was really interesting to see.
That's a very different test.
Yeah.
One of the things you asked was whether there are unique elements or aspects of different languages.
Yeah.
And certainly the Chinese is one of the most challenging assessments that we have in terms of building something that is appropriate, largely because of the characters. It's kind of a binary thing. You either know a character or you don't.
Yes.
And so which characters do you choose? There's no real set standard, as we understand it, that is commonly agreed upon for the order of learning characters in Chinese. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess in China, the government has certain lists, but textbook companies in the U.S. seem to have a very different approach. So that's been a real challenge. French, we find that French reading scores are just higher, and we don't know why. And it's true, we do work for the U.S. government as well, some of the tests that we build for them, we see the same thing. So by any means of analysis, they're at a certain level, say intermediate, mid. And yet students will regularly score higher than you would expect them to. And we're not sure exactly what it is, whether it's some sort of internal thing where students who take French happen to be a certain type of student that are particularly focused or whatever, or whether it's because of the cognates. There are so many words that are similar to English and Spanish. But that just seems to be something that always occurs.
Yeah, I see that in our data with the French, especially in the French immersion, because we have so many of them taking the assessment that I always see. I know that column's going to be significantly higher than the rest. Now it's good to know there's some information behind why.
Well, for me as a French teacher, all the more reason to try to push them even more with their reading ability and the articles and things we find. Sure, it's an advanced level, but and you're a level one student, but chances are you're going to be able to pick some things out of it and figure mm-hmm. some stuff out. So.
Great. So that goes back with the teaching skills, right? Because in Chinese, you're right. I mean, there's no way to phonetically sound these things out. There are no cognates mm-hmm. to English. So you have to teach them those skills of how to pick out the main idea and what, you know, focus on what you do know and what versus what you don't know. And that's where that skill base comes in that can help them prepare for these tests.
And then language is always changing, right? So in China, we're seeing texting is becoming a very influential element in the language. So regular Chinese are beginning to learn pinyin, whereas before they wouldn't really know it at all. But because they type in Roman letters mm-hmm. and then it's converted to the characters, that's becoming a more common understanding of language. And so that's sort of bleeding into the language itself in China. And that's going to have an impact on what we teach, what we assess, those kinds of things.
Yes.
Can I jump in here and ask a question really fast? First of all, I should point out that David came directly from the airport to us, and that is
yeah,
incredible.
Really nice.
Like, you're so nice to do that. That's so great. I just am totally curious to know, and you can just answer this in a Reader's Digest answer, but when you decide, for example, when you decide we're going to do German now, where do you even start? Do you let AP tests influence you? Do you start with a native group of speakers and readers and writers and say, you know, or just a collection of authentic material and you kind of build it from there? Where do you even start when you decide we want to build a test for this language, like especially like this Creole language you're talking about? I don't even know where you would go to start there.
So that's a great question. For STAMP, we've developed a format. So there's a formal structure for both the STAMP 4S, which is for grades 7 and up, and STAMP 4SE, E for elementary, which is grades 5 down to 2 or sometimes lower, depending on the school. We don't have people who speak every language as native speakers, so yeah, we have to work with specialists, who we call target language experts. We just happen to have somebody who's a native German speaker working for us, so that makes it a little bit easier. But we have a team of content developers who've got experience. Bill Alford is our VP of content. He's based down in the Monterey, California area. He worked for ETS for many years developing. He wrote the law boards and wrote TOEFL tests and then worked at Defense Language Institute for many years as a test developer. So he joined us 6 years ago, I think. So Bill has a lot of expertise in test development. And then we have managers, Jan Beck up in Portland, who's the German. So as a team, and Victor Dos Santos is a Brazilian who just got his PhD out in Iowa. They all have assessment expertise, and then we bring in experts who are linguists, who are native speakers. They're generally college professors in the language, and they develop the passages in the language. We tell them what we need, what kinds of passages we need. They'll generate the passages. They'll do a rendering into English so we understand generally what it is that's being said. And then we work together to identify the assessment points in the passages, be they listening or reading. And then we go through reviews. We have a panel of experts who, again, are linguists, generally college professors. And there's something called an Angoff panel. You get into all these really obscure kind of terms in this field. But there's somebody named Dr. Angoff, who's still actively practicing as a linguist and test developer, who came up with a process for bringing in experts who would analyze what we call items, the questions, to see if they're on level or not, and whether the assessment points are the appropriate ones to be measuring, and if they're measured appropriately. If the options, what we call, more technical stuff here. The correct answer is the key, and the other four choices or three choices are called distractors. So the distractors have to be plausible. They can't be too obvious. They can't be too confusing, because we're not trying to trick people.
Right.
We really want to understand whether they grasp the meaning or not. So they go through that process, and then we put it out as an assessment. In some cases, we'll do field testing. So with the Chinese, we're revising the Chinese test to level the Chinese reading more mm-hmm. appropriately because it got a little too hard. So we'll be doing field testing where we have students actually take the test and we gather that data, analyze it, and then we know with great accuracy how difficult each question is. And then we can put them into the test so that we have the proper adaptive structure for the test.
I think our Chinese students are going to be in on that.
Good.
So good. That'll be exciting.
Yeah, we'll be good. Another question I had was, who rates the stamp and what goes into rating those samples? For example, you mentioned there are the four aspects, reading comprehension, listening comprehension, writing, and speaking. And I know the comprehension ones, they get a score pretty immediately.
It's immediate. Mm-hmm. The computer scores it.
Yeah. Boom. And how does that go about determining, you started addressing that, but determining where they are? I just find it fascinating because, like, we've been developing integrated performance assessments for levels 1, 2, and 3. And what I've seen, district-wide, they're still very basic. But in my classroom, as I've been trained on them to a greater extent, I've thrown out full IPAs to my class. And what I've seen is that the more I can ask them about the reading, the more I can really hone in on how deeply they're understanding. Mm. And so I just find it really interesting how you're able to target their comprehension. And so I just can't believe it can be done so quickly. It's really interesting.
Once you have the data on the individual items, you can really pinpoint how difficult they are. We use something called computer adaptive multi-stage testing. Again, getting really geeky here, but instead of typical adaptive test algorithm, you answer one question. If you get it right, you get a more difficult one. If you get it wrong, you get an easier one. We use this method that was developed in the early 2000s back in North Carolina by a professor named Rick Lecht that uses little mini tests as you go through. So everybody gets the first batch of 10 questions, 10 items that are kind of at a middle level. We group them that way so that you have topic variation because it just happens. Somebody may not know mm-hmm. anything about the weather, but they may know a lot about food. And so to be fair and accurate, you need to balance those topics. You also need to balance the levels because you're going to have some really ones on the hard end of intermediate, say, and on the easy end of intermediate. So you need to balance those. Then they either move up, stay the same, or go down. And then there's three bins, what we call them, little testlets, as you go through the test. Once you go through that test, the algorithm and the computer, we've just written all this technology so that it can go back and calculate exactly what your level is. So I don't understand how it works in terms of the math, but I just know that it works. And yeah. We have statisticians who really understand how that all works. Then once you are identified at a certain level by the computer, say you're intermediate mid, then you go into, in listening, then you go into the speaking section. And your speaking prompts are based on your score in the listening section.
Because that was another question I had, because I thought, how can you determine necessarily, because I was telling my students, you get three prompts, and that's it. So I was wondering if there was some way of tying that in. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. So, and again, that's the advantage of an adaptive test. You can really hone in on what their level is. But some kids are going to be better listeners than speakers. So we don't want to disadvantage them or overwhelm them. But they'll get two prompts at that level. Say they're intermediate, mid, and in listening. They'll get two intermediate prompts, and they'll get one advanced prompt. Because we always want to give them the chance to show their best.
Right.
And then if we have, in the scoring, one of the items being off, either too low, we'll throw that one out. Because, again, we want to give them the chance to do their best. In the old days, we used to have items that we'd write as novice items, and you'd be limited, so you couldn't actually demonstrate anything but novice skills. So write a list of food at the grocery store. Well, you can't show intermediate skills if all you're doing is listing out vegetables.
Yeah.
So we've stopped doing that. But in any event, does that answer your question?
Yeah. Yeah. So then, moving on from those. So then who scores?
Right.
Yeah.
So we, primarily we have retired teachers or teachers taking a break. They may be home for a while. You have to have a bachelor's degree. You have to be at least advanced, depending on the language, advanced high. You have to take the STAMP test. So we have everybody take the STAMP test, but also we'll look at OPI scores or other assessments that they may have taken. And then they have to go through our training program. So this is a program that we've actually started to provide to schools now for training teachers in the standards. But we'll take them through a program where they learn the standards and they actually practice on responses. So we'll have canned student responses from real students. And we'll mark them up to show why they're at the level that they're at. And then so they go through and practice and feel comfortable, then they'll take a test. And if they have 90% agreement with our master rater scoring, then they're certified to assess. They have to go through and recertify if they haven't scored. I think it's in a month. So if they haven't been actually scoring for a month, they have to go back and recertify. So that's really what it is.
Okay. I have just learned so much. I knew it was computer adaptive, and I've always explained that to my parents, to my administrators, to the teachers, but I didn't know it had the complexity that you've explained in the computer adaptive part. That's fascinating.
Talk to Kyle or somebody that really understands it.
Someone that really can get geeky about it, I'm guessing. Yeah, that's amazing. And one of the things I love about the stamp data that we print out, that single sheet we get with the four little pyramids, is I think that when you see that third score that's higher, so it's showing that they're intermediate mid, for example, but then there's that little blue line because one of their assessments in their writing or speaking was higher. Mm-hmm. That is so valuable because then we can turn to kids and say, see, you may be intermediate mid, but you're approaching intermediate high and what you can do to get the rest of the way. And I didn't know that it's because you're throwing out a harder prompt for the other level when you see those kids getting up to that.
But we That's do write really the prompts cool. now so that even at intermediate, they're able to demonstrate advanced skills. Because we, as I said, you know, we've learned over the past 16 years we've been doing this to write prompts that really allow students to show all that they can do.
Yep. That's one of the reasons we love the assessment.
I feel like, why do I even write my own test? That sounds way cooler than tests I can make. That's awesome.
I know some teachers really like the Apple test, which I've never seen or taken. I've heard a lot about. And my understanding is that that has a more of an interpersonal aspect to it. So I was curious if you have any plans to address an interpersonal aspect or if you don't, and if not, why? Just to throw that out.
Yeah, that's a great question. We get that a lot. And it certainly has been helpful to us to see how teachers have reacted to that. And many of them do like that item type. And it's on the AP assessment as well. As you know, there's a kind of a dialogue. Mm-hmm. We're looking at that, and I think we will over time have an item type of that nature. We want to make sure we do it right. There are some challenges to that. You have to make sure that you structure the questions so that the students can give enough language to score at the higher levels. Some of the complexity of language that's required in order to score at the advanced level is difficult to do in a sort of a canned interview format. In an OPI, which is an oral proficiency interview, where you're actually engaging in a conversation with a tester, you can negotiate meaning, and so you can poke and pull language out that is difficult to do in sort of that computer format.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the trouble is, in a computerized assessment, you have to make compromises. But you have the ability then to test large number of students to get standardized objective data that you can't get in an individual one-on-one assessment in the same way. So there's trade-offs. But yeah, we're going to look at that very closely.
Yeah. Okay. And that's interesting because with our IPA assessments that we create, when we got into the interpersonal mode, that was a big debate when we got into our very first one last year, is what are we going to do and how are we going to address that? And so I submitted, well, this is what they do on the AP test. And if it is too problematic on a large scale to address a truly interpersonal task and record that and show evidence, then maybe we go that way. Maybe we go the route of the AP test, which, as you say, presents a lot of challenges. And that's a lot of the brushback that we've been getting is they can't negotiate meaning. If they don't hear something, then what are we supposed to do? Because then they can't fully address that. And it's just hard. And that's kind of what the conclusion we've come to is you have to make some compromises, yeah, in order to
no,
get something.
No assessment's perfect. You know, I mean, the only real perfect assessment is just jumping into Colombia or Venezuela or Hunan or wherever and just seeing how you do. And that's what STAMP and that's what we all as educators are trying to do to replicate that for the students so right. that when they get in that situation, they'll feel comfortable and not afraid.
Right. That was exactly Brandon's line a few weeks ago is he kind of views that as the future of assessment if it were plausible.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, as you look at the future, there are a lot of trends and we see, I don't know, assessment and learning merging. Technologies enabling that to occur. We're seeing artificial intelligence come in, and that's going to have a big impact. Virtual reality, those elements are...
That'd be amazing, like incredible, seriously.
Yeah.
We were just talking about, because there's this new virtual reality thing down that you went down to in Linden or something,
yeah.
right? And you were talking about how that could be applied to... Even foreign languages, so.
Yeah,
and well, the Ghostbusters weren't
yeah, Ghostbusters wouldn't necessarily play so much, but.
Well, I saw a demo back in Washington. There's a monthly meeting of government language people. It's open to the public, so if you're ever back in D.C. on, like, the second Friday of the month, and you're really interested, it's fascinating to see what the government is doing in language. But there's a think tank back there that had a VR language learning program, and it was a cocktail party in Moscow, and there were different conversations going on. There was an American from the embassy speaking to a Russian businessman. There was, you know, some other people over here. There were politicians. And with your eyes, you could move from one conversation to the other because you know how your mind can concentrate on one conversation at a time. So you could switch. I mean, I'm not sure whether that was that pedagogically impactful, but just the idea that you could start building tools that would allow you to do those kinds of things and figure out ways to use them in the classroom in a way that mimics reality much more accurately was just amazing. It was really fun to see.
Yeah, there was something during my master's degree program, they talked about, I'm probably going to butcher it, I think it was called gameology or gamification is what they called it, yeah. And, it was really neat, and I remember reading a few articles, and one had a link to a website where they had started to design this game that you could play. And so I went there to see it because I thought this would be really cool. This would be catchy to kids. And I went there, and it was something like, this site doesn't work anymore.
Oh, no.
I thought, oh, dang it, because the ideas are unbelievably good, and I could just see this being so helpful. And I just thought everything that I looked into just came to a dead end. And so like Brandon was saying, I went to it's one of the top of the line virtual reality places in the world from what I read up on it, just here in a small town, Linden, because they're the creators and they had
Second Life?
No, I can't remember.
It's the Void. I think it's
the Void.
They've got one in Dubai as well.
One in Dubai, one in New York.
Huh. And one in Linden.
And one in Linden, Utah.
Yeah.
Nine years.
New York.
Yeah, one of these things. So I went with some friends, and it was so cool. And you could see where it's got room to grow. And it was short. It was 10 minutes. But all that gamification stuff came back to mind as I was walking through that and blasting the Marshmallow Man. And I just thought, boy, if language could somehow get in there, And if instead of running into dead ends all the time, if something could happen, this could just be, I mean, mind blowing and just a whole new paradigm for world language. But yeah, so I just thought that was really interesting.
We all want to go do it now.
One really interesting thing that we've noticed, and we talked about it a little bit earlier in the podcast, was that with the stamp data in our district, we've noticed a correlation between stamp scores and AP scores. You already addressed that to a pretty good...
Yeah, so I could explain that a little bit more. We started doing it that year with you because it was high stakes and the parents were very nervous about what was going on. And so, like I said, I had a hypothesis that that would hold true. And sure enough, that year was 100% correlation between what your students performed on the AP test and what we thought they would based on their stamp test. And so since then, we administer the stamp test every February in all of our AP class. So when that gives us enough time to get the data back, get it to the teachers and to the parents and kids, and also make any adjustments in our programs that we might need to based on the data. Maybe they have a low reading score. They could stand to do a little bit more independent reading at home or whatever. And it also helps us encourage kids to have the courage, I guess, to take the AP test, because some students don't understand that they're AP material and why we would never use the stamp data to discourage someone, because just taking the AP test is a value enough. It's not about whether you get a 2, 3, or 4. It's the experience that you did it. So we use it to encourage more students to take it so they will realize that, you know, I really am prepared for this. And so every year, you know how it is. It's July and we're waiting for the data to come out on maybe July 8th or whatever. And as soon as it comes out, we've already done all of our data and organized it. You'll call me with your student scores, and then Jill Carmiel from Farmington will call me with hers, and we start putting it into where we thought they were, would be, and what they actually did. And so since 2011 or 12, when we started doing this, we have one time we had one student score lower than we thought, and we'll occasionally have students score higher than we think, but almost always there's a correlation between what we thought they were going to score and what they actually got. So that's really exciting, because that gives the teacher some breathing room when they know they've prepared their kids well and the kids know that they're ready to take it as well. But one year we did something different, and that was at one of our high schools. The kids did really well on the stamp, but they hadn't taken the AP class. So they were pretty proficient in the language, but the AP test is not a proficiency test. It's a performance test. So you do the AP themes and you have the skills of writing an email and defending your beliefs on certain things, your cultural comparisons and things. So I just suggested to this teacher, let's have your students take the AP test because their proficiency is so high. Well, interesting enough, those kids only passed at 50% of the rate we thought would pass. Mm-hmm. So we thought all these 30 kids, their proficiency was high enough to pass, but they did not have the knowledge base. So that just tells us that the AP test, you've got to have a marriage between content knowledge and proficiency.
Yeah.
So if the kids have the content knowledge, they've been through the course and they're well prepared by their teachers, and they have the proficiency, then they are likely to score exactly what they think.
Yeah, that is interesting, because I've always been a believer that familiarity breeds confidence. And so I give my students at least one practice AP test, like from start to finish every term, because I want them to walk in knowing they're not going to walk into any surprises other than what's the content that's being thrown at me. So yeah, I think that's good for us AP teachers to grow our programs mm-hmm. and be able to tell them that there is tremendous value in the class, if for no other reason than that. I've also used the stamp data to sit down with all of my level fours and walk through each aspect with them and say, okay, this is where you're looking in your reading comprehension, your listening comprehension. This is where you're a little weaker, and this is where you're really strong. And I've been able to tweak that so that fourth term for their homework, I always give them homework that it's not worth a whole lot on their grade, but it's just because I know it will help them. 30 minutes a week of either reading, writing, listening, or speaking outside of class.
And I see fourth term is always open to them. So it's very nice when we get our stamp data back to be able to see, okay, your listening is a little low. So it's still open to you, but this is good, a good indicator that maybe that's what you need to be doing with your homework this term to build that. And it's also been really nice to be able to show those students who are maybe a little lacking for confidence that look what you can do. Like, look, mm-hmm. you've already, at least with the Spanish aspect of it, you've qualified for the syllabi literacy. Or, you know what? Our data over the last however many years has shown that you're likely to score this on the AP test, or that you've at least got a really good chance at passing. And it's been really motivating, encouraging, and validating for a lot of students to be able to reference back to that.
I agree. I would say in Chinese, we really administer very few AP tests every year, but it's almost, I don't know, I guess I always thought of this as like a game. I'm like, you need to be at novice high at the end of the year or whatever. And so they would work really hard because they wanted to get there. And when they got there, or most of the time, they would exceed wherever they needed to be. It was such a confidence builder, which is big for our Chinese programs because we have a hard time retaining students because of the level. I mean, just learning Chinese just takes longer to become proficient. And so, I don't know, I kind of used it as a game, and it kind of building off of what you said, it did build confidence, and that builds competence.
Right. It's just nice for them to see, like, okay, it's not just Senor Burt saying, I'm really good at Spanish. Like, now I have outside proof that I can do things. And yes. I think that's just really nice for them to see and hear.
And we've talked last week in our podcast about how grades in the past haven't reflected proficiency. So a student could have an A, but maybe they weren't proficient, and we're changing that. But the stamp is, that's the feedback of where they really are proficiency wise. And if teachers can use proficiency vocabulary with their students and explain to them what the different levels are, that really helps student achieve it, because then they know where the goal is and where they're at, when the final destination is. And so they can actually be conversant about what's going to be working. And I wanted to talk, if you don't mind, a little bit about where else we use the stamp.
Yeah, please.
So in the state of Utah, it's a law, and I don't think we're alone, but students can get credit by demonstrated competency. So in our content area, the stamp test is how we give students credit for demonstrated competency. So if you have a student who is a native Spanish speaker or native German speaker in your schools, maybe they're an exchange student, maybe they moved here with their parents or something, and they can get 2 high school credits by taking the stamp test and passing it at the proficiency level that we would expect at the end of year 2. So any student in high school is eligible to take the stamp test. They just arrange it through the district assessment offices. They come in, I order their tests, and they sit down and they get the 2 years of high school credit. So I think that is an area that we could really improve and do more on, because a lot of students could be getting 2 years of high school credit that they're not currently getting. We could also use that to put them into a higher level of a language class right off the bat. And we also use it with our immersion students when they get to the secondary level, because when you're learning a language in elementary school, you're filling that lower part of the pyramid so quickly with every little thing you acquire shows so much on the proficiency pyramid. And so you just think, it's a miracle. My kids are learning the language so amazingly. And then when they get to junior high, we're in the intermediate range. Some kids are even in the advanced, and it takes forever to proceed through those proficiency ranges, even though they're acquiring the language at the same rate or nearly the same rate. So parents and students think nothing's happening, and it is. And so we use the stamp assessment in all of our immersion secondary classes every spring, and then we can see where the kids are, and maybe they've only moved from the lower end of intermediate. You know, maybe they're intermediate low and they get up to intermediate mid. The parents may not have seen that growth over the year. And so we're able to create these really great charts that we share with our parents to show this is where the whole class was in seventh grade. And here's where they all are at the end of eighth grade. So they see that big progression, and that really helps, because parents are a little bit nervous in immersion because they've been invested since these kids were 5 years old, and they're nervous if they don't see the growth. But it's happening, and the stamp tool is a great one for us to use to show parents and other stakeholders. I mean, administrators really care as well. So that's another area we use the stamp and for great effect in our programs.
Do you use the scaled scores to show the growth in the cohorts?
We use the scale score with the teachers and students one-on-one. I don't collect that data or save it at the district level, but the teachers use it because with the writing and, or with the reading and listening, those scale scores will show up. And so it, maybe that's how they grew over the years. Maybe they were at the lower end of intermediate, mid, and now they're at the higher end, and that will be reflected in the scale score. So the teachers use that with their students, but I don't save that data at the district.
Another question I had that came up while Bonnie was speaking was I have a lot of heritage speakers, and every now and then I get some native speakers. And I had some a couple years ago, and we did our stamp testing. And there were these two girls that scored much lower than I ever would have fathomed. Hmm. And so I attributed it to, I might be using the wrong term, but I think it was the access skills, that their Spanish, where that's their native language, and their English was quite weak, that they had a hard time understanding some of the questions. And that's what I saw on the AP test as well. One scored a 3. I couldn't believe she could be anything other than a 5, because she's just this unbelievably intelligent girl, very, very bright and sharp. And I just was a little surprised. And so that's part of the reason I asked Bonnie at the beginning of this year if I could get some funding to have my heritage speakers take the heritage speaker assessment, which brought in other data to look at. I thought it was going to be more similar to stamp test results. And so I'm just wondering what you might recommend for native speakers of a language or maybe...
What grade are they? They're all secondary?
Yeah.
Okay. I ask because the stamp 4SE for elementary students requires very little English.
Okay.
It's mostly picture clicks or zone clicks. There's very little explanatory information in English. And what there is, we've now converted so that they hear it in both English and the target language, whatever that is.
Right.
For the regular stamp test, we have heard this a lot. So we did an experiment last year based on some requirements from San Francisco Unified that we do the Cantonese, Mandarin, and Spanish assessments. In the speaking and the writing sections, they wanted to make sure that we had all the prompts, both in English and in the target language. So now we've expanded that. So this year, all of our languages will have prompts in both Spanish,
in your case,
English.
Yeah, I think
so that should help. The reading and the listening are still going to be that English. And we say that in order to be, to have a situation where the English isn't an impediment, they should be at least, intermediate mid in English.
Oh, okay.
So,
yeah, and a couple of the people I'm thinking of were not.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And it would be great to convert everything over, but it's so that we're purely monolingual, but it's difficult if a lot of the answer choices, if you wrote them in the target language, it would give away the answer.
Right.
So you'd have to come up with different questions most of the time. But yeah, that's a challenge. There's some interesting research that's been done on heritage speakers and test taking too, language test taking. Dr. Carrera in Long Beach State and UCLA is a Cuban, or she came from Cuba, so a heritage speaker of Spanish. She's done a lot of research on test taking by heritage speakers, largely of Spanish, and found that they generally underperform. And the reason is that they see the assessment as a test of knowledge rather than a test of language. So if you have a task to explain something, they'll explain it and they're done. So they don't think about demonstrating their linguistic skills.
Okay.
It's knowledge to them because that's what it is in any other subject. So there is a body of research that shows that there are some particular challenges for heritage speakers when taking language tests. And part of that, I imagine, in order to groom them for success is explaining what is expected of them, that they should speak as much as they can.
Yeah.
We've changed the instructions on our assessment so that we now explain that they should use as much language as possible, use complex phrases when possible. And it's a compromise, because in a pure proficiency test, you shouldn't say anything. Here's a prompt, do what you can, because that's what you do in the real world, right?
Yeah.
Nobody's telling you to use more complex phrases or explain with more language. But we just didn't see the language coming in that we needed to see in order to properly give these students the level that they deserved. So we've compromised and done that. And those explanations, of course, are all in both English and the target language.
Yeah. Okay. Well, and that's insightful in and of itself, because I have a particular student in mind that it's hard to pull a whole lot of language out of him.
Yeah.
He's a heritage speaker. And so when you say that it's viewed as giving knowledge and not expanding on their language abilities and so forth, that provides me with something to work on with that student. So thank you.
Yeah, sure.
We have been very, very fortunate to have Mr. David Bong with us today, CEO and co-founder of Avant Assessment. We've also been joined by Kelsey and Bonnie Flint, no relation again. And we just would like to close, again, discussing the correlation that exists between what we do as teachers and what David does as an outside party specializing in assessment. We need people like David creating assessments like that, having external assessment. The role of external assessment, which we started talking about previously in regards to competency-based education, the role of external assessment is for us to get an objective look at where our students are, and it also provides us something to drive towards. It gives us a goal.
I would just add that as teachers, we're just general practitioners of education, and we're not assessment experts. Like when we use the stamp for right now levels 4 and 5 for most of our languages here, or I guess, sorry, 4 and AP kids. To me, that's such a, it almost feels like the burden is lifted on that level, because I can let that happen externally and focus all my energy and core passions of being a teacher in the teaching part and preparing them for that. Like preparing assessments, in my personal opinion, is hard.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
and it's,
absolutely.
And it's stressful too, because you're trying to think, how do I ask this question just right to get the right, elicit the right response, a response, give them enough room to show me what they can do. And, you know, we've talked so much about how to word questions. And so anyway, we definitely need people like David. And so we're grateful for that.
Well, I just appreciate the chance to be able to meet you all and sit here and talk about all this stuff that I really love doing. So, we're very passionate about language. We really believe in the power of language. And as you've said, I can't say it any better. You know, having an assessment that serves as a goal that comes close to what you're trying to achieve in the real world, is really important. It's not everything. The teaching and the learning are really what matters. But having an outside assessment that's objectively scored can give you the feedback that can help you understand what areas you can, both as a teacher and as a student, improve on and where to focus your energy. So if we can be a little help, we're happy.
Yeah. Well, again, thank you very much for being here and for running over straight from the airport. That couldn't have been easy.
That's so nice of you.
And with that, I'll say hasta luego.
Auf Wiedersehen.
A plus.
Deva mata.
Thanks for getting down with Level Up.